Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to the 177th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. I'm FNH. Today we're starting off with the 8th part of the 39 Steps, and then we'll have a musical number from 1929, and then on to part 2 of Lovecraft's Dreams in the Witch House. Let's get started. Chapter 8, The Coming of the Black Stone. I came down to breakfast next morning after 8 hours of blessed dreamless sleep to find Sir Walter decoding a telegram in the midst of muffins and marmalade. His fresh rosiness of yesterday seemed a thought tarnished. "I had a busy hour on the telephone after you went to bed," he said. "I got my chief to speak to the First Lord and to the Secretary of War, and they're bringing Royer over a day sooner. This wire clinches it. He'll be in London at 5. Odd that the code word for a sous-chef d'état major general should be porker." He directed me to the hot dishes and went on. "Not that I think it will do much good. If your friends were clever enough to find out the first arrangement, they're clever enough to discover the change. I would give my head to know where the leak is. We believed there were only 5 men in England who knew about Royer's visit, and you may be certain there were fewer in France, for they managed these things better there." While I ate, he continued to talk, making to my surprise a present of his full confidence. "Can the dispositions not be changed?" I asked. "They could," he said, "but we want to avoid that if possible. They are the result of immense thought, and no alteration would be as good. Besides, on 1 or 2 points, change is simply impossible. Still, something could be done, I suppose, if it were absolutely necessary. But you see the difficulty, Hanny. Our enemies are not going to be such fools as to pick Royer's pocket or any childish game like that. They know that would mean a row and put us on our guard. Their aim is to get the details without any one of us knowing, so that Royer will go back to Paris in the belief that the whole business is still deadly secret. If they can't do that, they fail. For, once we suspect, they know that the whole thing must be altered." "Then we must stick by the Frenchman's side till he is home again," I said. "If they thought they could get the information in Paris, they would try there. It means that they have some deep scheme on foot in London which they reckon is going to win out." Royer dines with my chief, and then comes to my house, where 4 people will see him. Whittaker, from the Admiralty, myself, Sir Arthur Drew, and General Winstanley. The First Lord is ill and has gone to Sheringham. At my house he will get a certain document from Whittaker, and after that he will be motored to Portsmouth, where a destroyer will take him back to Havre. His journey is too important for the ordinary boat train. He will never be left unattended for a moment until he is safe on French soil. The same with Whittaker, till he meets Royer. That's the best we can do, and it's hard to see how there can be any miscarriage. But I don't mind admitting that I'm horribly nervous. This murder of Carolides will play the deuce in the chancelleries of Europe. After breakfast, he asked me if I could drive a car. "Well, you'll be the chauffeur today, and wear Hudson's rig. You're about his size, you have a hand in this business, and we're all taking risks. There are desperate men against us who will not respect the country retreat of an overworked official." When I first came to London, I had brought a car and amused myself with running about the south of England, so I knew something of the geography. I took Sir Walter to town by the Bath Road and made good going. It was a soft, breathless June morning, with a promise of sultriness later, but it was delicious enough swinging through the little towns with their freshly watered streets and past the summer gardens of the Thames Valley. I landed Sir Walter at his house in Queen Anne's Gate punctually by 11:30. The butler was coming up by train with the luggage. The first thing he did was to take me round to Scotland Yard. There we saw a prim gentleman with a clean-shaven lawyer's face. "I've brought you the Portland Place murderer," was Sir Walter's introduction. The reply was a wry smile. "It would have been a welcome present, Bullivant. This, I presume, is Mr. Richard Hannay, for whom some days greatly interested my department?" "Mr. Hannay will interest you again. He has much to tell you, but not today. For certain grave reasons, his tale must wait for 4 hours. Then, I can promise you, you will be entertained and possibly edified. I want you to assure Mr. Hanny that he will suffer no further inconvenience." This assurance was promptly given. "You can take up your life where you left it off," I was told. "Your flat, which probably you are no longer wishing to occupy, is waiting for you, and your man is still there. As you were never publicly accused, we consider that there was no need of a public exculpation, but on that, of course, you must please yourself." "We may want your assistance later on, MacGillivray," Sir Walter said as we left. Then he turned me loose. "Come and see me tomorrow, Hannay. I don't need to tell you to keep deadly quiet. If I were you, I'd go to bed, for you must have considerable arrears of sleep to overtake. You had better lie low, for if one of your Black Stone friends saw you, there might be trouble." I felt curiously at a loose end. At first, it was very pleasant to be a free man, able to go where I wanted without fearing anything. I had only been a month under the ban of the law, and it was quite enough for me. I went to the Savoy and ordered very carefully a very good luncheon, and then smoked the best cigar the house could provide. But I was still feeling nervous. When I saw anybody look at me in the lounge, I grew shy and wondered if they were thinking about the murder. After that, I took a taxi and drove miles away up into North London. I walked back through the fields and lines of villas and terraces, and then the slums and the mean streets, and it took me pretty nearly 2 hours. All the while, my restlessness was growing worse. I felt that great things, tremendous things, were happening or about to happen, and I, who was the cogwheel of the whole business, was out of it. Royer would be landing at Dover. Sir Walter would be making plans with a few people in England who were in the secret, and somewhere in the darkness, Black Stone would be working. I felt the sense of danger and impending calamity, and I had the curious feeling too that I alone could avert it, alone could grapple with it. But I was out of the game now. How could it be otherwise? It was not likely that cabinet ministers and admiralty lords and generals would admit me to their councils. I actually began to wish that I could run up against one of my three enemies. That would lead to developments. I felt that I wanted enormously to have a vulgar scrap with those gentry, where I could hit out and flatten something. I was rapidly getting into a very bad temper. I didn't feel like going back to my flat. That had to be faced sometime. But as I still had sufficient money, I thought I'd put it off until next morning and go to a hotel for the night. My irritation lasted through dinner, which I had at a restaurant in Jerome Street. I was no longer hungry and let several courses pass untasted. I drank the best part of a bottle of Burgundy, but it did nothing to cheer me. An admirable restlessness had taken possession of me. Here was I, a very ordinary fellow with no particular brains, and yet I was convinced that somehow I was needed to help this business through, that without me it would all go to blazes. I told myself it was sheer, silly conceit. The 4 or 5 of the cleverest people living, with all the might of the British Empire at their back, had the job in hand. Yet I couldn't be convinced. It seemed as if a voice kept speaking in my ear, telling me to be up and doing, or I would never sleep again. The upshot was that at 9:30 I made up my mind to go to Queen Anne's Gate. Very likely I would not be admitted, but it would ease my conscience to try. I walked down Jerome Street, and at the corner of Duke Street passed a group of young men. They were in evening dress and had been dining somewhere, and they were going on to a music hall. One of them was Mr. Marmaduke Jopley. He saw me and stopped short. "By God, the murderer!" he cried. "Here, you fellows, hold him! That's Hanny, the man who did the Portland Place murder!" He gripped me by the arm, and the others crowded round. I wasn't looking for any trouble, and my ill temper made me play the fool. A policeman came up, and I should have told him the truth, and, if he didn't believe it, demanded to be taken to Scotland Yard, or, for that matter, to the nearest police station. But a delay at that moment seemed to me unendurable, and the sight of Marmy's imbecile face was more than I could bear. I let out with my left, and had the great satisfaction of seeing him measure his length in the gutter. Then began an unholy row. They were all on me at once, and the policeman took me in the rear. I got in one or two good blows, for I think, with a fair play, I could have licked the lot of them. But the policeman pinned me behind, and one of them got his fingers on my throat. Through a black cloud of rage, I heard the officer of the law asking what was the matter, and Marmy, between his broken teeth, declaring that I was Hannay, the murderer. "Oh, damn it all," I cried. "Make the fellow shut up. I advise you to leave me alone, Constable. Scotland Yard knows all about me, and you'll get a proper wigging if you interfere with me." "You've got to come along with me, young man," said the policeman. "I saw you strike that gentleman cruel hard. You began it, too, for he wasn't doing nothing. I seen you. Best go quietly, or I'll have to fix you up." Exasperation and an overwhelming sense that at no cost must I delay gave me the strength of a bull elephant. I fairly wrenched the constable off his feet, floored the man who was gripping my collar, and set off at my best pace down the Duke Street. I heard a whistle being blown, and the rush of men behind me. I have a very fair turn of speed, and that night I had wings. In a jiffy, I was in Pall Mall, and had turned down towards St. James's Park. I dodged the policeman at the palace gates, dived through a press of carriages at the entrance to the Mall, and was making for the bridge before my pursuers had crossed the roadway. In the open ways of the park, I put on a spurt. Happily, there were few people about, and no one tried to stop me. I was staking all on getting to Queen Anne's Gate. When I entered that quiet thoroughfare, it seemed deserted. Sir Walter's house was in the narrow part, and outside of it three or four motor cars were drawn up. I slackened speed some yards off and walked briskly up to the door. If the butler refused me admission, or if he even delayed to open the door, I was done. He didn't delay. I had scarcely rung before the door opened. "I must see Sir Walter," I panted. "My business is desperately important." That butler was a great man. Without moving a muscle, he held the door open and then shut it behind me. "Sir Walter is engaged, sir, and I have orders to admit no one. Perhaps you will wait?" The house was of the old-fashioned kind, with a wide hall and rooms on both sides of it. At the far end was an alcove with a telephone and a couple of chairs, and there the butler offered me a seat. "See here," I whispered. "There's trouble about, and I'm in it. But Sir Walter knows, and I'm working for him. If anyone comes and asks if I am here, tell him a lie." He nodded, and presently there was a noise of voices in the street, and a furious ringing at the bell. I never admired a man more than that butler. He opened the door, and with a face like a graven image waited to be questioned. Then he gave them it. He told them whose house it was, and what his orders were, and simply froze them off on the doorstep. I could see it all from my alcove, and it was better than any play. I hadn't waited long till there came another ring at the bell. The butler made no bones about admitting this new visitor. While he was taking off his coat, I saw who it was. You couldn't open a newspaper or a magazine without seeing that face, the grey beard cut like a spade, the firm fighting mouth, the blunt square nose, and the keen blue eyes. I recognised the First Sea Lord, the man, they say, that had made the new British Navy. He passed my alcove and was ushered into a room at the back of the hall. As the door opened, I could hear the sound of low voices. It was shut, and I was left alone again. For 20 minutes I sat there, wondering what I was to do next. I was still perfectly convinced that I was wanted, but when or how I had no notion. I kept looking at my watch, and as the time crept on to 10:30, I began to think that the conference must end soon. In a quarter of an hour, Royer should be speeding along the road to Portsmouth. Then I heard a bell ring, and the butler appeared. The door of the back room opened, and the First Sea Lord came out. He walked past me, and in passing he glanced in my direction, and for a second we looked into each other's face. Only for a second, but it was enough to make my heart jump. I had never seen the great man before, and he had never seen me. But in that fraction of time something sprang into his eyes, and that something was recognition. You can't mistake it. It is a flicker, a spark of light, a minute shade of difference which means one thing and one thing only. It came involuntarily, for in a moment it died and he passed on. In a maze of wild fancies, I heard the street door close behind him. I picked up the telephone book and looked up the number of his house. We were connected at once, and I heard a servant's voice. "Is his lordship at home?" I asked. "His lordship returned half an hour ago," said the voice, "and has gone to bed. He's not very well tonight. Will you leave a message, sir?" I rang off and almost tumbled into a chair. My part in this business was not yet ended. It had been a close shave, but I had been in time. Not a moment could be lost, so I marched boldly to the door of that back room and entered without knocking. 5 surprised faces looked up from a round table. There was Sir Walter, and Drew, the War Minister, whom I knew from his photographs. There was a slim elderly man who was probably Whittaker, the Admiralty official, and there was General Winstanley, conspicuous from the long scar on his forehead. Lastly, there was a short, stout man with an iron-grey moustache and bushy eyebrows who had been arrested in the middle of a sentence. Sir Walter's face showed surprise and annoyance. "This is Mr. Hannay, of whom I have spoken to you," he said apologetically to the company. "I'm afraid, Hannay, this visit is ill-timed." I was getting back my coolness. "That remains to be seen, sir," I said. "But I think it may be in the nick of time. For God's sake, gentlemen, tell me who went out a minute ago." "Lord Alloa," said Walter, reddening with anger. "It was not," I cried. "It was his living image, but it was not Lord Alloa. It was someone who recognised me, someone I have seen in the last month. He had scarcely left the doorstep when I rang up Lord Alloa's house and was told he had come in half an hour before and gone to bed."
Who?
Someone stammered. "The Black Stone," I cried, and I sat down in the chair so recently vacated and looked round at the 5 badly scared gentlemen. Today's music is a 1929 track by Irene Bodoni. It's called Believe Me.
The Cuban draws his dagger to fight for his grisette. Then nonchalant and swagger, he lights his cigarette. "I've got a dashing boyfriend, who'll die for just one kiss. He phones me every morning to tell me this. Believe me, I'd chase a tiger right into his den if you said I had to do it to kiss you. And then, believe me, I'd make that tiger sing kiss me again. I'm just so crazy for you. And listen, if any lion should stand in my way, believe me, I'd twist his tail till he'd look up and say, oh, mister, please let me go, 'cause I don't want to play. I'm sorry. I would keep the wolf from your door if he should venture in. It'd be just a rug on your floor when I get through with him. Believe me, like the old woman who lived in the shoe, oh honey, I'd be contented to live there with you. And baby, I've got a shoe that will hold me and you. Believe me. Believe me. Sharks in the ocean would not worry me if you said I had to swim from New York to Paris to take you into my arms for a honeymoon spree. I'm just so crazy for you. And listen, if some big elephant should stand in my track, believe me, I'd make that elephant sit down on the tack till he would pack up his trunk and be glad to turn back and leave me. I would be your toreador and throw the bull for you. I would be the knob on your door, even be your doormat too. Believe me, I'm not a boaster, and I'm not a crank. But honey, I chase a Scotchman right into his bank and make him give you his money and even say thanks. Believe me.
And so on to part two of our Lovecraft story, Dreams in the Witch House. Gilman did not report his fever to the doctor, for he knew that he could not pass the examinations if ordered to the college infirmary when every moment was needed for cramming. As it was, he failed in Calculus D and Advanced General Psychology, though not without hope of making up lost ground before the end of the term. It was in March when the fresh element entered his lighter preliminary dreaming, and the nightmare shape of Brown Jenkins began to be accompanied by a nebulous blur which grew more and more to resemble a bent old woman. This addition disturbed him more than he could account for, but finally he decided that it was like an ancient crone whom he had twice actually encountered in the dark tangle of lanes near the abandoned wharves. On those occasions, the evil, sardonic and seemingly unmotivated stare of the beldame had set him almost shivering, especially the first time when an overgrown rat darting across the shadowed mouth of a neighbouring alley had made him think irrationally of Brown Jenkin. Now, he reflected, those nervous fears were being mirrored in his disordered dreams. That the influence of the old house was unwholesome he could not deny, but traces of his early morbid interest still held him there. He argued that the fever alone was responsible for his nightly fantasies, and that when the touch abated, he would be free from the monstrous visions. Those visions, however, were of absorbing vividness and convincingness, and whenever he awakened, he retained a vague sense of having undergone much more than he remembered. He was hideously sure that in unrecalled dreams he had talked with both Brown Jenkin and the old woman, and that they had been urging him to go somewhere with them and to meet a third being of greater potency. Toward the end of March, he began to pick up in his mathematics, though the other studies bothered him increasingly. He was getting an intuitive knack for solving Riemannian equations, and astonished Professor Upham by his comprehension of fourth dimensional and other problems which had floored all the rest of the class. One afternoon, there was a discussion of possible freakish curvatures in space, and of theoretical points of approach or even contact between our part of the cosmos and various other regions as distant as the furthest stars of the transgalactic gulfs themselves, or even as fabulously remote as the tentatively conceivable cosmic units beyond the whole Einsteinian space-time continuum. Gilman's handling of this theme filled everyone with admiration, even though some of his hypothetical illustrations caused an increase in the always plentiful gossip about his nervous and solitary eccentricity. What made the students shake their heads was his sober theory that a man might, given mathematical knowledge and admittedly beyond all likelihood of human acquirement, step deliberately from this earth to any other celestial body which might lie at one of the infinity of specific points in the cosmic pattern. Such a step, he said, would require only two stages. First, a passage out of the three-dimensional sphere we know, and second, a passage back to the three-dimensional sphere at another point, perhaps one of infinite remoteness. That this could be accomplished without loss of life was in many cases conceivable. Any being from any part of three-dimensional space could probably survive in the fourth dimension, and its survival of the second stage would depend upon that alien part of the three-dimensional space it might select for its re-entry. Denizens of some planets might be able to live on certain others, even planets belonging to other galaxies or to similar dimensional phases of other space-time continua, though of course there must be vast numbers of mutually uninhabitable, even though mathematically juxtaposed bodies or zones of space. It was also possible that the inhabitants of a given dimensional realm could survive entry to many unknown and incomprehensible realms of additional or indefinitely multiplied dimensions, be they within or outside the given space-time continuum, and that the converse would likewise be true. There was a matter for speculation, though one could be fairly certain that the type of mutation involved in a passage from any given dimensional plane to the next higher one would not be destructive of his biological integrity as we understand it. Gilman could not be very clear about his reasons for this last assumption, but his haziness here was more than overbalanced by his clearness on other complex points. Professor Upham especially liked his demonstration of the kinship of higher mathematics to certain phases of magical lore transmitted down the ages from an ineffable antiquity, human or pre-human, whose knowledge of the cosmos and its laws was greater than ours. Around the 1st of April, Gilman worried considerably because his slow fever did not abate. He was also troubled by what some of his fellow lodgers said about his sleepwalking. It seemed that he was often absent from his bed, and that the creaking of his floor at certain hours of the night was remarked by the man in the room below. This fellow also spoke of hearing the tread of shod feet in the night, but Gilman was sure he must have been mistaken in this, since shoes as well as all other apparel were always precisely in place in the morning. One could develop all sorts of oral illusions in this morbid old house, and did not Gilman himself, even in daylight, now feel certain that noises other than rat scratching came from the black voids beyond the slanting wall and above the slanting ceiling? His pathologically sensitive ears began to listen for faint footfalls in the immemorial sealed loft overhead, and sometimes the illusion of such things was agonizingly realistic. However, he knew that he had become a somnambulist, for twice at night his room had been found vacant, though with all his clothing in place. Of this he had been assured by Frank Elwood, the one fellow student whose poverty forced him in a room in this squalid and unpopular house. Elwood had been studying in the small hours, and had come up for help on a differential equation, only to find Gilman absent. It had been rather presumptuous of him to open the unlocked door after knocking had failed to rouse a response, but he had needed the help very badly, and thought that his host would not mind a gentle prodding awake. On neither occasion, though, had Gilman been there, and when told of the matter, he wondered where he could have been wandering, barefoot, and with only his night clothes on. He resolved to investigate the matter if reports of his sleepwalking continued, and thought of sprinkling flour on the floor, on the corridor, to see where his footsteps might lead. The door was the only conceivable egress, for there was no possible foothold outside the narrow window. As April advanced, Gilman's fever-sharpened ears were disturbed by the whining prayers of a superstitious loom fixer named Joe Mazowitz, who had a room on the ground floor. Mazowitz had told long rambling stories about the ghost of old Keziah and the furry sharp-fanged nuzzling thing, and had said he was so badly haunted at times that only his silver crucifix, given him for the purpose by Father Iwaniki of St. Stanislaus Church, could bring him relief. Now he was praying because of the witch's Sabbath which was drawing near. May Eve was Walpurgis night, and hell's blackest evil roamed the earth, and all the slaves of Satan gathered for nameless rites and deeds. It was always a very bad time in Arkham, even though the fine folks up at the Miskatonic Avenue and high Saltonstall streets pretended to know nothing about it. There would be bad doings, and a child or two would probably be missing. Joe knew about such things, for his grandmother in the old country had heard tales from her grandmother. It was wise to pray and count one's beads at this season. For 3 months, Keziah and Brown Jenkin had not been near Joe's room, nor near Paul Chernowski's room, nor anywhere else, and it meant no good when they held off like that. They must be up to something. Gilman dropped in at the doctor's office on the 16th of the month and was surprised to find his temperature was not as high as he had feared. The physician questioned him sharply and advised him to see a nerve specialist. On reflection, he was glad that he had not consulted the still more inquisitive college doctor. Old Waldron, who had curtailed his activities before, would have made him take a rest, an impossible thing now that he was so close to great results in his equations. he was certainly near the boundary between the known universe and the fourth dimension, and who could say how much further he might go? But even as these thoughts came to him, he wondered at the source of his strange confidence. Did all of this perilous sense of imminence come from the formulae on the sheets he covered day by day? The soft, stealthy, imaginary footsteps in the sealed loft above were unnerving. And now, too, there was a growing feeling that somebody was constantly persuading him to do something terrible, which he could not do. How about the somnambulism? Where did he go sometimes in the night? And what was that faint suggestion of sound which once in a while seemed to trickle through the confusion of identifiable sounds, even in broad daylight and full wakefulness? Its rhythm did not correspond to anything on earth, unless perhaps to the cadence of one or two unmentionable Sabbath chants, and sometimes he feared it corresponded to certain attributes of the vague shrieking or roaring in those holy alien abysses of dream. The dreams were, meanwhile, getting to be atrocious. In the lighter preliminary phase, the evil old woman was now of fiendish distinctness, and Gilman knew she was the one who had frightened him in the slums. Her bent back, long nose and shriveled chin were unmistakable, and her shapeless brown garments were like those he remembered. The expression on her face was one of hideous malevolence and exultation, and when he awakened he could recall a croaking voice that persuaded and threatened. He must meet the black man and go with them all to the throne of Azathoth at the centre of the ultimate chaos. That was what she said. He must sign the book of Azathoth in his own blood and take a new secret name now that his independent delvings had gone so far. What kept him from going with her and Brown Jenkin and the other to the throne of chaos where the thin flutes pipe mindlessly was the fact that he had seen the name Azathoth in the Necronomicon, and knew it stood for a primal evil too horrible for description. The old woman always appeared out of thin air near the corner where the downward slant met the inward slant. She seemed to crystallize at a point closer to the ceiling than to the floor, and every night she was a little nearer and more distinct before the dream shifted. Brown Jenkin, too, was always a little nearer at the last, and its yellowish-white fangs glistened shockingly in that unearthly violent phosphorescence. Its shrill, loathsome tittering struck more and more into Gilman's head, and he could remember in the morning how it had pronounced the words Azathoth and Nyarlathotep. In the deeper dreams, everything was likewise more distinct, and Gilman felt that the twilight abysses around him were those of the fourth dimension. Those organic entities, whose motion seemed least flagrantly irrelevant and unmotivated, were probably projections of life forms from our own planet, including human beings. What the others were, in their own dimensional sphere or spheres, he dared not to try and think. Two of the less irrelevantly moving things, a rather large congeries of iridescent, prolately spheroidal bubbles, and a very much smaller polyhedron of unknown colours and rapidly shifting surface angles, seemed to take notice of him, and to follow him about, or float ahead as he changed position amongst the Titan prisms, labyrinths, cube and plane clusters and quasi-buildings. And all the while, the vague shrieking and roaring waxed louder and louder, as if approaching some monstrous climax of utterly unendurable intensity. During the night of the 19th and 20th of April, the new development occurred. Gilman was half involuntarily moving about in the twilight abysses, with the bubble mass and the small polyhedron floating ahead, when he noticed the peculiar, regular angles formed by the edges of some gigantic neighbouring prism clusters. In another second, he was out of the abyss and standing tremulously on a rocky hillside bathed in intense, diffused green light. He was barefooted and in his night clothes, and when he tried to walk, discovered that he could scarcely lift his feet. A swirling vapour hid everything but the immediate sloping terrain from sight, and he shrank from the thought of the sounds that might surge out of that vapour. Then he saw two shapes, laboriously clawing their way towards him, the old woman and the little furry thing. The crone strained up to her knees and managed to cross her arms in a singular fashion, while Brown Jenkin pointed in a certain direction with a horribly anthropoid forepaw, which it raised with evident difficulty. Spurred on by the impulse he did not originate, Gilman dragged himself forward, along a course determined by the angle of the old woman's arms and the direction of the small monstrosity's paw. And before he had shuffled three steps, he was back in the twilight abysses. Geometrical shapes seethed around him, and he fell dizzily and interminably. At last he woke in his bed, in the crazily angled garret of the Eldritch old house. He was good for nothing that morning, and stayed away from all his classes. Some unknown attraction was pulling his eyes in a seemingly irrelevant direction, for he could not help staring at a certain vacant spot on the floor. As the day advanced, the focus of his unseeing eyes changed position, and by noon he had conquered the impulse to stare at vacancy. About 2 o'clock he went out for lunch, and as he threaded the narrow lanes of the city, he found himself turning always to the southeast. Only an effort halted him at a cafeteria in Church Street, and after the meal he felt the unknown pull still more strongly. He would have to consult a new nerve specialist after all. Perhaps there was a connection with his somnambulism. But meanwhile, he might at least try to break the morbid spell himself. Undoubtedly, he could still manage to walk away from the pull, so with great resolution, he headed against it and dragged himself deliberately north along Garrison Street. By the time he had reached the bridge over the Miskatonic, he was in a cold perspiration, and he clutched at the iron railings as he gazed upstream at the ill-regarded island, whose regular lines of ancient standing stones brooded sullenly in the afternoon sunlight. Then he gave a start, for there was a clearly visible living figure on that desolate island, and a second glance told him it was certainly the strange old woman whose sinister aspect had worked itself so disastrously into his dreams. The tall grass near her was moving too, as if some other living thing were crawling close to the ground. When the old woman began to turn towards him, he fled precipitately off the bridge and into the shelter of the town's labyrinthine waterfront alleys. Distant though the island was, he felt that a monstrous and invincible evil could flow from the sardonic stare of that bent, ancient figure in brown. The south-eastwards pull still held, and only with tremendous resolution could Gilman drag himself into the old house and up the rickety stairs. For hours he sat silent and aimless, with his eyes shifting gradually westward. About 6 o'clock, his sharpened ears caught the whining prayers of Joe 2 floors below, and in desperation he seized his hat and walked out into the sunset golden streets, letting the now directly southward pull carry him where it might. An hour later, darkness found him in the open fields beyond Hangman's Brook, with the glimmering spring star shining overhead. The urge to walk was gradually changing to an urge to leap mystically into space. And suddenly, he realized just where the source of the pull lay. It was in the sky. A definite point amongst the stars had a claim on him and was calling him. Apparently, it was a point somewhere between Hydra and Argo Navis, and he knew that he had been urged towards it ever since he had awaked soon after dawn. In the morning, it had been underfoot, and now it was roughly south, stealing towards the west. What was the meaning of this new thing? Was he going mad? How long would it last? Again, mustering his resolution, Gilman turned and dragged himself back to the sinister old house. And that's it for today. Opening music was, as always, provided by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project. And this file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Until next time.
cthulhupodcast.co.uk.